Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching the Romanoffs. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
For the next few weeks, we will be covering the Amazon series The Romanoffs, all episodes written and directed by Matthew Weiner. If you have any feedback for us, we haven't had any emails for a little while, so I just wanted to remind you that you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. This week, we'll be covering episode 3, House of Special Purpose, directed by Matthew Weiner and co-written by Matthew Weiner and Mary Sweeney. Also, in this episode, we will have an interview with episode star Jack Houston. But before we get to that, Richard and I want to break down the episode, talk about some of the larger sort of discussion around the series itself and how that's reflected in this particular episode. We felt like this was a really good episode to talk about some of the meta stuff as it comes to Matthew Weiner, because this is an episode about the making of an episode of TV. So a perfect little, Russian nesting doll of a story for us to break down. The basic premise being, and I'm going to go through this really quickly because I have actually heard from some people who are listening to this podcast but not watching the show. So, that's whatever. Wow. Thank you. I'm glad you guys like listening to our voices so much that, you want to do that. But, the premise of the show, of this particular episode, is that Christina Hendricks plays an actress named Olivia who was brought on sort of in the midst of the production of a miniseries about the Romanoffs. But instead of, this modern, the Romanoffs loose interconnected thing that Matthew Weiner has done for Amazon, this miniseries about the Romanoffs is a historical depiction of their last days and sort of what happened in their relationship with the mad monk Rasputin and all of that. And things go from bad to worse for Olivia on the set of this show. And what we wind up getting is, I think a pretty sharp commentary on, what showbiz, and all the,
prestige television.
I'm glad to see that there's a female co-writer on this episode, because I think a lot of this is about sort of the difficulties of being a woman, in a production like this, both for Christina Hendricks' character, Olivia, and Isabelle Huppert's character, Jacqueline, who is an actress turned director on the project. Other people of note in this episode, Paul Reiser plays Olivia's agent, Bob Isaacson, or manager, and Mike Doyle plays an actor called Brian, who's playing Tsar Nicholas, who has like one of the funnier moments in the episode. I guess I want to start, Richard, you texted me, I think, or messaged me when you were watching this episode to say you especially loved it. So what are some of your broader thoughts on why this episode stands out for you?
I mean, I like a backstage kind of thing. I always find that interesting. And I really liked, the mix of tone and sort of style. It's half backstage comedy. It's half kind of supernatural. Well, no, it's not halves, it's thirds, it's quarters. I don't know. It's just like, it's a lot of different things. The supernatural aspect of it. The sort of darker satire. I just think it's really well fused together. It kind of reminded me of a weird mix of Clouds of Sils Maria and Personal Shopper, which are both Olivier Assayas movies that I'm a big fan of. And one is about ghosts, and the other is about acting and, being a woman in the industry, and sort of, going somewhere intense in the middle of nowhere and having strange things happen. So, you know, it spoke to me on all those levels. And, obviously any episode of television, movie, what play, whatever it wants to be, in which Isabelle Huppert and Christina Hendricks get to exchange really, really biting insults, is up my alley.
It's interesting because the first time I watched this episode through, I was looking for like the solution, of, you know, what's happening to her, trying to figure it out. And then when I was rewatching it a bit today, you know, knowing that there isn't really an easy answer, I was then able to just sort of like relax and lean into watching it, if that makes sense. And, your comparison to Clouds of Sils Maria, Personal Shopper, like you mentioned that to me when you watched it. So I had that in my mind as I was rewatching it today. And I was like, oh yeah, like the what isn't really the point. The point is like the frustration and disorientation that she's feeling. Is this actual like, is she being gaslit? Is this, you know, a byproduct of her grief having, you know, the Olivia character has just lost her mother? You know, is it just an absurdist sort of commentary on what it's like to be a performer? I would say yes, like to all those things, you know, and so that's what it feels like to me. And I really enjoyed it much more, like unclenching a little bit and letting that sort of wash over me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's something to be said, and you see this, in a lot of, independent cinema today, mostly foreign, like non-English language stuff, where it's sort of just, I mean, I guess Altman did this too, but like, it's just kind of a mood that holds a kind of cloud that holds lots of different interesting strands, interesting conversations about things. And like you said, nothing is solved or resolved, but like, I think that you have to kind of realign your expectation for something when watching something like that. But if you can settle into it and just be like, you know, we're not really getting anywhere linearly exactly, but we're just, they've just built an interesting house for a lot of like, important or, you know, salient discussions. I think you can really get into it.
Yeah. And I think especially as you mentioned this like dynamic between the Jacqueline character and Olivia as like two women in the industry talking about, you know, the hard road that they've had to walk to get where they are and the way in which they're like, you know, disinclined to cede any of the power that they've had to snatch in order to make things easier on the other person, or at least the Jacqueline character seems to be in that place. And that is really interesting, I think, especially right now as we talk about sort of like women in the industry and what it takes to get where you are and the implication of what both of them have had to do to get where they are. And, you know, you watch this episode and the Olivia character, like, she's nice and she's polite throughout until she gets like pushed. But the, you know, the implication we get at the beginning of the episode is that like Olivia will always, she will be nice to the PAs and the costume people and stuff like that. But she has an expectation of like what her stature has earned her. Which is, you know, it comes out in this conversation she has early on with, the Paul Reiser character where she says, like, you know, there was no like fruit basket, no flowers, no thank you card, no nothing in my room. And that on the one hand could seem entitled, but on the other hand, like watching it the second time, I was just sort of like, if you're an actress or anyone insecure walking into the midst of something that's already like existed without you, I'll just speak for myself. I really need to feel like I'm wanted there. And that's what like the first part. And then the whole thing really is like her doubt that she's even wanted, that she's needed. Why is she there? You know, and then the pressures of trying to perform under that cloud of like, am I even wanted here? What happened to the woman who was here before me? Everyone's talking trash on this actress who was here before me. Like, are they going to talk trash on me after I'm gone? All of that. That just like mood, as you say, of uncertainty and doubt and suspicion that it all creates that I found really fascinating.
Yeah, because I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, mostly with Olivia, but also with Jacqueline, where it's about women trying to figure out in a really male dominated industry, a male dominated world, or, you know, patriarchal world, where to assert themselves and how to do it and how much of themselves to give up. You know, I feel like that's why acting, or performance is, such a good sort of allegorical, framework for this kind of story. I mean, you see it in Black Swan to some extent. You see it in, like, I don't know, French Lieutenant's Woman, maybe, like, where, because the whole idea of this art is supposedly to give up yourself. But for women, that comes loaded with a lot of other implications, and, you know, it's one thing for a method actor to walk around and be sort of in his role and, you know, give himself over to the director's whims. But what does that mean for a woman, even if it's a woman directing it, you know? And I think that I'm grateful that that stuff was mulled over while also, you know, we were told this kind of weird, interesting sort of story. That said, I think it's also telling that this is the first of the episodes we've seen so far that has a co-writer on it, and it is a woman. You know, given what's going on with Matthew Weiner right now.
Yeah, so this is maybe like the entryway to talk about that is that, you know, we actually got a couple people. I hesitated to even mention this. We got a couple people asking us not to do this series as a podcast installment because of the accusations, fairly credible accusations around Matthew Weiner in terms of the way in which he treated at least one female member of his staff, but maybe women in general, or actually maybe just people in general, who worked for him on Mad Men. I don't know, Richard, what are your thoughts on this, and what, if any, hesitancies do you have around, I don't know, doing this podcast at all?
I mean, I was certainly hesitant, and I think that, you know, something that people in our line of work have to sort of consider is, now, am I being hesitant about it because I don't think it's worthy of being covered, or because I don't want to deal with the, you know, the sort of blowback, if, you know, from people who are saying, why are you covering it? You know, and I don't honestly always know the answer to that. I think that I certainly avoid covering certain topics or reviewing movies in a certain way because I'm just like, oh, there's a way to talk about this movie without addressing X, you know, and that's a failing on my own part. And, you know, so I think that for me, I believe that Matthew Weiner, you know, has been, you know, I believe people say who say that he's been mistreated them, harassed them even. But it feels, oh God, I don't know. It feels different somehow. Is that at all fair? Is that a horrible thing to say?
No, I don't think it's a horrible thing to say at all. I think the thing that I would say is, you know, like, the chief allegation against Matthew Weiner comes from a former assistant of his, and then she was later a staff writer on Mad Men, Kater Gordon. She won an Emmy in 2009 for co-writing a season 2 episode, and then was not back on the series. And she says that Weiner, one night when they were working on the series, that he said to her that he was owed getting to see her naked.
Right.
The thing that's interesting to me about this whole particular allegation, is that I don't know that I've ever seen Weiner really, like, deny it, in that I think he would say, yeah, I say things like, that was a joke, and I say things to people, and I treat people in a certain way, and I probably shouldn't, but that's, you know, that's something that I did. And Marty Noxon, who worked on Mad Men, said she believed Kater Gordon when she said this. The thing is, like, I can see someone like Matthew Weiner saying that, and I can see him seeing it as, like, something sort of harmless or boy clubby, and it being very much not harmless or boy clubby for the woman who experienced it, you know? And yeah, him having this, like, tunnel vision of, you know, one world view, and it wasn't that long ago. 2009 is not that long ago, but it's still actually quite a long time ago in our culture. And so, I don't know. It's complicated, I think, for both of us. I'm definitely not trying to make excuses for anyone at all.
No.
And I don't think either of us are saying we don't believe this woman and what she said is true. But I don't know that if in my personal threshold of what gets you quote unquote canceled these days and what doesn't, that I consider this like a cancellation of Matthew Weiner. I consider it a troubling part of his legacy. I consider it a potential that he learned from that experience. I consider there to be potential that he didn't learn from that experience. But what's also interesting is having talked to a lot of people who worked on this project, you know, nobody has told me a similar story about the Romanovs. So I don't know. I mean, like, what do you...
We're sorry that we're stumbling over this. It's just, it's hard. And Joanna and I don't, we don't talk about this on mic much, you know, or like publicly. But, you know, I'm thinking back to the Wesley Morris piece that he wrote for the New York Times about sort of cancel culture and, you know, when do we decide to sort of cast something, you know, cast something aside because of what its creator did. And it's a complicated piece. I think it's a little bit reactionary in a way. You know, I think he's setting up some kind of false equivalences. And I think that a lot of people who responded to it agreeing with him, it seemed like it was a lot of, I don't know, straight white people who were saying, oh, thank God you're right. Like, we, you know, they were kind of just saying, oh, we don't have to be concerned about this at all, actually, like, because cancel culture has just gotten out of hand. And I certainly wouldn't want to, like,
no,
find myself in that same space of being like, oh, see, I can point to this and that's why I can cover whatever I want, no matter who, you know, who made it or whatever. And I don't feel that we're there with covering this show, but, it's something that I'm trying to be conscious of, in terms of exonerating myself, from having to pay attention to things. You know, just last night I tweeted something about a comedian and I was watching her Netflix special and I said, oh, it's really funny. And then like immediately two people were like, Richard, like XYZ, here's why she's bad. And I went and looked and I was like, oh, you're right. And I, you know, I was like, you know, I just, I needed to know more about her. And, you know, I deleted the tweet. Maybe I shouldn't have. I don't know, but like this is all a process. And I think that in this show's case, ignoring it, or I guess we're kind of hot giving it special highlight by having it on this podcast, but like I think that just pretending it doesn't exist isn't exactly the way to do it. Maybe people out there disagree with how engaged we are with this show, but I think that there is reason to be, and it's thus far in this episode included proven that merit.
Yeah, and I think we have to just constantly be honest with ourselves about where our line is, where our threshold is. I'm not gonna, like, I do think cancel culture has gotten out of hand a little bit, but that's not to say I think it's necessarily a bad thing, because I do think there needs to be strong pushback on so many people. And so I'm not here to tell you, listener, or any, or someone who's chosen not to listen to this podcast because Matthew Weiner's canceled for them, who does or does not deserve to be canceled by you. Cancel whoever you want. It's even a weird phrase that we even say this nowadays, cancel someone. Cancel whoever you want. I am not going to automatically cancel every single person you're going to cancel, though. So for myself, Matthew Weiner still has some interesting things to say, even in both the ways in which he consciously engages in this, which I think he must be doing in this episode, and in the ways that he is oblivious to it, and that is of interest to me. And I mean, that's how I feel about Mad Men. I think Mad Men is getting like a bit of a, I don't know, a reconsideration in the wake of the Matthew Weiner, I don't know, allegation. You know, some people are like, well, was Mad Men sort of really actually bad all along or something like that? And I mean, to that I say a hearty no. And I would say there are ways in which Mad Men was aware of itself and engaging with the dynamic that it was putting forth. And there are ways in which Mad Men was nostalgic for that dynamic at the same time. And I find it interesting to watch a creator grapple with both of those things. And I think what we see in the Romanovs is a creator who is both skewering power and entitlement of men, and in some cases women, and also just like his fascination with it belies worshipfulness of that kind of power. Matthew Weiner, I think, is in and of himself a contradiction, and the way in which he explores that contradiction is interesting to me and to Richard, and maybe to you, listener.
And I think you're right, you know, that we're all going to have different metrics in terms of, you know, what we want to sort of grapple with and what we want to ignore. And some good things are going to go, you know, if we're going to try to do this reckoning as a culture and get to a place where we don't have to constantly say, well, this thing was made by this shitty person who did this shitty thing. Like, maybe we'll actually get to a spot where, like, good people are making good things. I don't know. Maybe that's naive, but yes, I would never mean to tell someone they're wrong for not wanting to watch the show. But, I, like you, am still interested in what Winer's doing. And I think a big part of that is he at least admits it happened. You know, he might, like, his context for admitting it might not be great, but, like, that's more than others have done. So, and I think it's interesting to go back to this episode that he's doing it with Christina Hendricks, who I think, I don't know, maybe you would disagree with me on this. I feel like Joan Holloway of the two main women three main women on the show suffered the most mightily on that show.
Yeah, I guess it depends on your definition of suffer, but absolutely, the compromises that she felt like, it's a similar thing. The compromise that Joan Holloway felt like she had to make in order to snatch whatever power she could in that position are different from the compromises that that both Betty Draper and Peggy Olson had to make, you know? And to us, a modern audience watching, more just blatantly harrowing, you know? And there's this gif. It's so funny because, like, Matthew Weiner, you know, I do want to bring it back more concretely to this episode, but I will say really quickly, it's funny. The lens through which we see a lot of this stuff is like Twitter and online and stuff like that. And it's funny to think of Matthew Weiner as like a canceled person, a canceled creator for some people. And at the same time, see that gif of, Joan and Peggy in the elevator being like, someday I just want to burn this whole place down, used like so often as like a fuck the patriarchy sort of iconic thing. And I'm just sort of like, yeah, the man who created that is someone, you know, it's like, that's the inherent contradiction. And so, yeah, I see a lot of parallels between Joan and this Olivia character, though the Olivia character is from this, like the Joan character at the beginning of Mad Men. It's sort of like Peggy shows up at the very beginning of Mad Men and she's sort of this like wide-eyed, doesn't know what she's doing. And Joan is much more seasoned and not necessarily kind to Peggy when she gets there, because Joan's like, I've carved out my space. You need to carve out your own. And I'm not here to carve it out for you. And I kind of feel like that's the flipped dynamic that we see in this, is like Olivia arrives at the set and she's very kind and sweet on the outside. And Jacqueline's like, that's nice. I'm not here to make a space for you. You have to make a space for yourself. And, you know, I've gotten to where I've gotten. You still have a road to go on your own. And I don't know. I just think it's interesting. Like something that you hear a lot about women who become directors or producers in these roles of power in Hollywood, like they feel like they have to be, even more, aggressive than their male counterparts in order to be taken seriously. I don't know that I would consider like Jacqueline like so like masculine in any way in her aggression, but she doesn't have space, to coddle anyone. And I find that a really interesting, portrayal.
Well, I think also there's something, I agree that it's an interesting character, and, you know, the way she sees it, she had to scrape and scramble just to get this one job. And, you know, we don't know exactly her full backstory. Maybe she did, but she was also a famous actress.
Right.
You know, so like in this way that a lot of people can position themselves in this sort of, you know, hero's journey narrative where that, you know, they beat all the odds to get where they are, but there's always, or not always, but a lot of the time there is a context around them, a sort of support structure that, you know, while Jacqueline is saying, you know, she is right maybe to say to Olivia, like, you need to figure out how to be here on your own. Thereby implying that she has, well, there were other institutional things helping Jacqueline get to where she is. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting dynamic. In that regard, I think it's also just interesting, and kind of nice in a way to have Weiner back in, you know, filming a workplace.
Because
he's so good at that.
Yeah.
And, just those dynamics and the ways that people can be, both cruel and supportive and undermining and collaborative. And, you know, I think that that's a very interesting aspect of the workplaces that he creates. And I think that's on display here. Do we think that it's, how much of this we are supposed to take, like, as fact? Do you know what I mean? Because I'm taking almost all of it very credibly, and I'm not sure, maybe I'm taking the wrong tack here. Does everything that we see actually happen?
If so, to what end? Like, I understand the end, you know, Olivia is sort of, like, duped into thinking that she's traveled back in time and she's part of this, like, final night of the Romanovs and stuff like that in order to deliver, like, the performance that is needed. But to what end the ghostly apparition in her room? You know, like, to what end a PA being told not to talk to her and pretend that she can't speak English? To what end a concierge, like, lying to her and saying there is no bar when there is one? Like, why gaslight your actress to that degree? Is it to make her more, you know, paranoid and unhinged the way that maybe Alexandra was in her final days? Like, what is the point of all this?
Yeah. So it's interesting though that you kind of have, were you reading it as all of this kind of weird stuff was all part of this broad plan to get her there? Or is it just that final bit where they staged the march to the execution?
It felt like that this woman was being messed with. I wasn't sure. This is all part of me trying to solve it when in the end I told you, like, I think the conclusion is I shouldn't try to solve it, but, like, that this woman was being messed with, in order to elicit the kind of performance from her that they felt like they needed. But it's, you know, and who cares what price, what toll that takes on her. And I see that as a, you know, as an extreme version of the paces that certain performers, actresses, or actors are put through by their directors. Do you see it as different? Do you see it as, like, symptoms of her grief or actual supernatural things happening, or what do you see about that?
I mean, I'm kind of going the actual supernatural things happening route for whatever reason.
Cool.
Just because I think it's there. Even earlier in the episode, there's this moment when, and it's a really striking moment, where she first gets to set and she meets Jacqueline and other people on the crew, and then they're ready to film a scene, which is basically just some, I think they're Bolsheviks, mm-hmm. out in the middle of the night throwing bodies into a pit and then lighting the pit on fire. I think it's supposed to be the Romanov bodies.
Yes.
And we see it, that kind of drags on, like the burying, like it takes a little while longer than, you know, I think we would see that, from her perspective anyway. And she's kind of looking at it horrified. And I think a couple interesting things are happening there. One being, I feel in a way it's kind of a commentary on the sort of ornate violence of prestige TV, like Game of Thrones or Rome or whatever, you know, that when you see it from her, from the vantage point of it being filmed and that it's all artifice, it seems kind of gross. So I thought that was interesting. But I think also looking back to the end of the episode, is that not some glimmer of the real, Alexandra almost inhabiting Olivia and seeing it through her eyes as if it's actually her family and herself, you know? So I feel like the ghosty, haunty stuff even kind of happens right there.
Well, what you have is the Samuel character played by Jack Huston and the Olivia character played by Christina Hendricks witnessing their character's own death from a remove, because you have that later scene where she and Samuel go watch Rasputin be dumped in the river, right? And I think it speaks to the larger question of this episode. In show business, or in the production of art, who is doing the chewing and who gets chewed up? And, like, I think the person doing the chewing, is the Paul Reiser character. I feel like you see, I would see the Jacqueline character as someone who has been chewed up and gotten to a place where she gets to do some of her own chewing for, you know, her art, she says. The Paul Reiser character, Bob Isaacson, who we meet mostly on the end of the phone and then is at the, you know, assures Olivia that he's come to rescue her, and at the very end, like, he and Jacqueline are the two hanging over her being like, it was worth it, basically, and she's dead, and Olivia's dead. You know, that they're the vultures, they're the consumers, and what's fun about the gender dynamics in this episode is that you've got, like, Jacqueline in this position of being able to chew people up, but, like, the Samuel character also seems to be chewed up, like, along with Olivia. Like, he gets thrown in a van and, like, taken off in the dead of night. Like, you don't know what happened to him there, right?
Oh, that's right. That's never resolved, is it?
No. And so, like, he's also, I mean, like, as much as he's sort of, like, a menace to her in certain ways, he's also sort of, like, tossed about by this production. And so you've got, like, men and women on both sides of this dynamic. And it's, that's pretty fascinating to me. Cause I think it would be, I really think this episode is less effective if you have a man in the Isabelle Huppert role. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's really much more interesting that it's two women sort of locked in this dynamic. And then you've got these satellite men also engaging in the dynamic. So.
And it's two women who it seems to be are the most famous people in the room. I mean, I think that, that Samuel's supposed to be famous, but, like, there's a lot of talk about how much power Olivia has. Obviously, Jacqueline has power. And yet they're telling a story that, you know, I don't know what this fake miniseries does with Alexandra or any of the other women, maybe Anastasia, whoever else. But, like, the story is one of men in a way, you know. I mean, you know, the leader of Russia was a man, and the Bolsheviks were largely men, from my understanding. Maybe I'm totally off about that, but you know, so that kind of challenges it. And I think that I do feel like, from the perspective of art about art, there's something. I like the idea of this production being cursed, having something to do with, like, what responsibility does this kind of fancy high gloss television owe to history and owe to its subjects, and this whole idea that you could just change the ending and they survive, and in fact, that's what the ghost of the Dowager would want, you know, if you believe that she was actually possessed Jacqueline's body.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's what Wiener having a little fun with, or Wiener having a little fun with his own legacy in terms of Mad Men and what so many other fancy so much other fancy television is trying to do, in terms of accuracy and, you know, I had to do this terrible thing because that's what happened. I had to do this. I had to treat these characters terribly because that's how they were treated. You know, we see that excuse trotted out a lot for Game of Thrones. Well, it was just it was a violent time. When was a violent time? This isn't a real thing, you know.
So, that's my favorite.
I think that maybe there's a little of that going on where we're supposed to be sort of appalled by the ahistoricity of a Romanov story that ends with them, you know, fleeing to Paris, but, like, but why? Like, why couldn't we just do that? This is all makeup, you know?
Yeah. And what's interesting, I hadn't thought about this, but when you brought up the Dowager, what's interesting is that these supernatural elements, or these Romanovs that are making themselves feel known in this episode, are all women, right? Because it's like a little girl ghost. It's the Dowager, Alexandra. I don't feel like I feel Nicholas or even Rasputin, despite the fact that Samuel has, like, a shrine to him, in his hotel room. That's an amazing bit of comedy, I think, in this episode. But, like, I don't feel like you get that male perspective, whereas you have these female ghosts sort of haunting this story and being like, what about us? What about our lineage? What about our legacy? What about what was done to us? You know? And the thing that you mentioned, in last week's episode where you mentioned how the Romanov women had, like, sewn their jewels in, you know, a possibly apocryphal story. The Romanov women had sewn their jewels inside of their dresses so that when they were shot, the guards had to then go through and stab them all because the jewels, like, deflected the bullets. And you see that in the reenactment that we get in this episode that, you know, I was like, oh, just wait for it. It's coming. But that's a brutality. That's a brutal thing that happened only to the Romanov women, you know, in this context. So I think that's interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, I this is coming out way before the movie will, but like there, in that way, it has an interesting parallel to Luca Guadagnino's remake of Suspiria, which I think is very much about supernaturally, you know, supernaturally gifted women, maybe let's say, getting some sort of revenge for the sins of history wrought by men, you know? I don't think that that's quite as, you know, on the nose here. I mean, it's not as about that as it is in Suspiria, but it's just interesting to think about that kind of thing of, you know, and even the way that I framed it. Well, this is a story about men. I mean, that was a dumb thing for me to say. No story on earth is about men, you know, only. I mean, there were always women affected. There were always women active, passive, whatever, you know, the whole gamut of things. And not always, and not every situation, but you know what I mean? Or am I crazy?
No, I know what you mean, but I think that that's exactly the point. It's like, it wasn't a dumb thing for you to say, but it's just sort of like, okay, Tsar Nicholas is in power and then these Bolshevik men overthrew him. And it's sort of like the women do just at times can feel like, you know, mothers and wives and daughters that are just sort of like, I don't know, insulation around the men and the movers of history. And, you know, that's what the era of Mad Men could be considered as well. But then, like, you know, that series, Mad Men, took us inside the lives of these women, that like trio of Peggy, Joan, and Betty, which are just like three very different women that I find so freaking fascinating. To the point where that story felt as much, or if not more, about them as it did about these like men that history remembers. And so, like, then this is, you know, the thing that history remembers. But what's interesting about the Romanov legacy is, like, it's not actually, you're right that it's a male story, like Tsar Nicholas and the Bolsheviks, stuff like that. But, like, what history remembers is Anastasia, like, a Romanov woman is, like, the most famous Romanov. So.
Yeah. And also, it's also funny that the Romanovs were terrible people.
Right.
Like, the Tsars lived lavishly while people starved to death, yeah, in Russia. Like, it was really bad. There's a reason the revolution happened.
Yeah.
And so I think all that veneration. And also the Dowager Ghost, like, she seems like a real piece of work. Like, she gave that lady a heart attack. Like, yeah. You know, so it's just, I think there's a lot of interesting things, happening on that front. And I think that, you know, having this conflict between women in the workplace in the here and now and today and women who are high status, and yet still, they are subject to a lot of the bad whims of the patriarchy. Like, I think that's interesting. What do you make of this scene when Olivia finally does find the bar and she and Jacqueline have that really nasty tete-a-tete? Is that like, I mean, I know what this episode was co-written by a woman, but is that like a man just kind of cheaply going for the you know, the quick insult, the obvious insult about, you know, someone sleeping with a guy or whatever, or getting old? Or does that, how does that scene play for you?
I think part of it played well for me and part of it didn't, if that makes sense. I think some of the things Jacqueline says about, like, you know, it's obvious what you're doing is so obvious, it's boring, I think is what she says. Mm-hmm. I think some of that stuff, though it sounds a bit more spiteful. I mean, it's just so interesting because, like, it seems like Jacqueline needs Olivia, but resents needing Olivia. And so then is lashing at Olivia. And that's, you know, a very complicated dynamic. But some of the stuff that Olivia says back, like, I just don't know that I felt the ramp up to that within the character, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, that line about it must be sad to watch the parade go by or something.
Yeah, that feels
like that's a nice piece of writing, but it's also like, ugh, like, I don't know. Yeah. It just didn't feel earned, I guess.
I agree with that. I would say that Olivia is the kind of, from what we've seen in the episode so far, Olivia is the kind of person who would, like, go running, like, not as an insult to her, because it's what I would do, go run crying to her room if she were attacked in that way. Do you know what I mean? Like, that she's,
yeah, like, her pushback doesn't feel that consistent with the rest of her character.
Right. Except for, I think, the pushback that we see in, like, the part where the Samuel character, like, sort of sexually assaults her in, mm-hmm, in this church scene. That does feel earned and right and a really compelling thing to watch.
She's so great in that scene. And, you know, like, I it's probably it is incalculable how many times that's happened, I'm sure, mm-hmm. at rehearsals for a play, on set for a TV show or a movie, that some guy under the guise, whether he's being sincere or not, of being in character, does something awful like that. Like that is like the story of, you know, women acting, unfortunately.
To sidestep that, quickly, just for like legal reasons, I just want to draw a quick line between what I'm about to say and what we just said. In other things, this character, the first person that I thought of when I saw this character was Jared Leto, and like a lot of the antics that he does on set, there's no indication or allegation that any of that has been sexual in nature, so that's not something that I'm saying, but like, we all have heard the Jared Leto stories of like Suicide Squad and like, I don't know, the dead pigs that he would send or whatever it was he did, and even something like Blade Runner, where like his character was blind, so that he made all these PAs like lead him around and he pretended to be blind. I don't know. It's just like all this exhausting sounding nonsense that Jared Leto does. And then you thought of like a more venerated actor who does a lot of method. But I think you brought up Daniel Day-Lewis, and like either way, I think the Samuel character is a really effective skewering of like a kind of actor, you know?
For sure. And I think the funny thing about that method thing, which again, Olivia does call him out on by name, you know, sort of spitting the method in his face. Is you look at someone like Daniel Day-Lewis, and who, you know, I don't know how apocryphal these stories are, but like supposedly he, you know, will get so into character that, you know, you're talking to Daniel Plainview for 3 months or whatever. And then you hear this about Jared Leto sending people pig's hearts and whatnot. And you look at those two performances and you're like, oh, well, maybe Daniel Day-Lewis is just a good actor. and like, maybe he could have gotten there no matter what. And, you know, the method is sort of bullshit, but, I don't mean to poo-poo an old, you know, acting theory, but it's, to me, if it's ever used to exonerate that kind of bad behavior or excuse right. that bad behavior right. rather, like, then the whole thing is completely ridiculous.
I guess I have no problem with your method as long as it isn't like a massive burden on all the people around you. When it gets to and when it gets to that point, then it's just sort of like, all right, buddy, like, let's just calm down. I think this is a good moment to go to my interview with Jack Houston, and I did ask him who he was thinking of when he crafted this role.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, Joanna.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, how are you?
I'm doing so well. Thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for speaking with me.
You're welcome. Well, I wanted to kick off by asking you how much you knew about the Romanovs or Rasputin before you started this project.
I knew a bit. You know, I've been saying it's a bit like that schoolboy history, you know, schoolboy friends, you know, like you know enough about it, but none of the real details. Rasputin, it's so funny. I remember his face or these pictures of him and those eyes, his startling eyes. So that was pretty cool when Matt called up and said you'd be playing both Samuel Barlow, the actor, and Rasputin. I was like, oh, well, that's a fun one to get into.
You're wearing contacts, obviously, right, for that,
look. Man, those contacts were brutal. They were brutal. They were, yeah, but they were like these amazing hand-painted sort of these, like, because, you know, Rasputin, as much for being sort of the mad monk and all the rest of it, he was known for his eyes, these sort of eyes that meant to sort of like mesmerizing, you know, you'd be transfixed when he looked at you, and they were meant to be this like almost translucent blue. So we actually, rather than just getting like natural contacts, we actually sort of exaggerated like the whole episode. We sort of exaggerated the color of them, and they were painted, and I put them in, and they were these thick. It was like having a couple of rocks in your eyes.
Oh, no.
So that was, yeah, but you know what? It all added to the character.
Well, you have such opportunity in this episode to, you know, make fun of or genuinely critique sort of nightmare filming projects. How much fun is that for you as an actor? Sort of, I don't know, exorcise previous bad experiences or whatever it might be through this particular show.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was, I have to say, we were laughing a lot in it. You know, that's the best part, is like every now and again, you know, the great thing about Matt is, you know, he's one of the great storytellers. And, you know, the good thing when we were making this episode, we were all sort of regaling each other with horror stories, which was making us laugh a lot, you know, things. Because sometimes, you know, although it's an exaggerate, you know, it's like I said, it's a culmination of every terrible experience one could have on every set put into one. It's like the worst ever set one could ever imagine themselves finding themselves on. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, even the characters, it's like, you know, it's like that exaggerated of like the type of act, the worst type of actor to work with, the worst director, the agent, the production itself, from, you know, above and below the line. So, you know, it's like that. I said, it's like a horror comedy. We were all laughing a lot in it, as well as like it being rather startling at certain times as well. So
obviously I would never ask you to name names, but I am curious if you had certain actors in mind when crafting Sam Barlow and his sort of extremes that he would go to in order to stay into character or to get the exciting
many. Benny. No, by the way, it's so funny. I'm hoping that people won't watch it and say, God, it was just like you.
You're like, oh,
that
no.
That would be the worst part. That would be the worst thing. No, it's funny because he's so sort of unlike me in many ways. But I guess when I said, that was sort of like the fun about doing it. Because, you know, when Matt called me, he was like, we have like a lot of connect tissue and people we've worked with. And, you know, he obviously from The Sopranos, and I got to work with David Chase on a movie, and then Terry Winter, obviously on Boardwalk, and then David O. Russell, they're great friends. So we have a lot of connected tissue. So he did come specifically to this. To me for this part, which I don't know if to take as an insult or I'm not entirely sure.
No, it's a compliment, a huge compliment.
It is a compliment. That's how I took it. He wasn't saying like, you know, but you know, we do talk about the method and stuff like that. I said I'm a character actor. I obviously you sometimes can't help but take something away with you when you're going into sort of like deeper, darker places, but Samuels takes it to a whole new level when she comes in and sees his shrine to Rasputin right. with the candles.
You mentioned that you and Matt, you know, have all these mutual people in common, but you got to work with Christina, who obviously has worked with Matt for so long.
Yeah.
Did she have any, you know, Matt is a very singular type of person to work with, both writer as a writer, director, visionary. Did Christina have any tips for you of sort of how to navigate this particular set?
Well, you know what, from the moment we sort of all got together, it was like the nicest set I've ever, everyone was so happy, including Matt. The one thing Christina said, she said to Matt, she's like, I've never seen you this happy. Because I think even for the 9 Emmys or whatever he got for Mad Men, I think he was pulling his hair out every day. Cause you know, I think it's just a tireless job. This was his passion project. He was so happy to be making this, and it so came through, and everyone was so sort of excited to be there. That, you know, the one thing she, you know, she said, which is to Matt's credit, she was like, the great thing is you always know you're in good hands. Like he will micromanage everything. I'm saying like to the, in the best possible sense. I'm not, that's in no way a negative thing. I loved it because you really completely give yourself over to him because he, you know, that he's thought about everything. You know, if a hair is out of place, how high the hands move, where your voice range should be at this moment, how you should look up, how to walk into a room. It's very, very, like I say, it's the complete opposite of the series that we were pretending to make.
Right. And what is your understanding of what the larger theme of the idea of the Romanovs and what that, you know, means, these like people who claim a heritage, who maybe claim to be exceptional, whether or not they are. Like what does that mean for the broader sense of the series and like for this episode specifically?
Okay. So the funny thing is I know nothing about any of the other episodes. So I have not read anything. I have not seen anything. I am going to be as surprised as anyone else when I'm watching it for the first time. Literally we were saying my episode, but I mean, our episode, maybe I'm not sure about the other episodes, but in ours, it's about identity. It's about confidence, about who we are. It's, our episode, I think is, I don't want to say a lighthearted because it's, you know, as we know, you know, what the big finale is of the episode, but I think Matt wrote our episode. I think it's one for entertainment. It's a very fun episode. Obviously, it's got the underlying connective tissue of the Romanovs and like one sort of who we are and obviously struggling with oneself. But, you know, that comes across as much, I think, as Christina's character as an actress, you know, in it. I'd say with Olivia, she's struggling with her identity, as is Jacqueline with her identity as a director and as a woman in the business, as they talk about how hard it's been, and then a rivalry. And then for me, very much my identity is like, you know, what a name does, and it is playing the role. You know, it's interesting. That's my episode alone. I don't know much about the other.
Well, no, that's perfect. And you know, it's interesting. I've heard that Matt had these, like a very specific set of rules, for these episodes that he, actually went to the length of printing out for himself. And among them are this idea of, banishing coincidence, avoiding pretension, and making sure each episode is self-contained. Are these rules something you guys talked about on set? And if not, you know, were there moments where you could see him like really trying to avoid, I don't know, pretension is a trap that's so easy to fall into?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was very aware of that and talked about it. And that was the thing, because that's my thing is Matt's one of the great storytellers. And I think Matt really about this, like it's entertainment. Like I'm saying, as much as the tissue, like it within the episodes, I think he's one of the, like, we're also watching this as an audience wanting to be entertained. And I think no one does that better. So he was very much like, you know, give yourself over to what we're doing in that funny way. Don't worry, you know, about it. Like, you know, that's the sort of fun of the job. And, you know, we should, you know, we're sort of making light of, not light, we're actually sort of, I always say about our episode is it's probably close, like everyone will be able to, within the business and outside the business, will be able to take something away from this episode, because it's, just because it happens on a set, like it's that the horror of working in an office or going to, you know, one's job in a, you know, building site or whatever it is. It's like, it's just one's meant to be a culmination of one's within oneself, their worst nightmare, in a sense. It's like a nightmare.
And do you, like, it's unclear to me, and I think it's probably meant to be unclear, whether or not there are actual sort of supernatural aspects of this episode. Do you believe that there is something supernatural going on, or what is your take on this particular episode?
Well, I do. I think there is. I think there's something supernatural going on. I mean, I don't know. That's the funny thing is that was what was sort of awesome about when we were shooting it is that everyone sort of had an opinion, but they all sort of changed. Like every person one to the other, which is sort of what the whole show's about, isn't it? So it was like everyone sort of I don't think anyone had a definitive answer, but my personal take on it is that I think some weird crap was happening, but there, but then it went a bit further than it should. You know, I mean, right. one played into it too much, but yeah.
And what's interesting to me is, you know, I just watched 6 episodes of the series, and each episode is about, you know, close to an hour and a half. And so to me, it feels like I was just at like a mini film festival. You know, each episode feels so cinematic and like it's its own contained, beautiful, independent film or something like that. You know, I was just wondering, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, Matt Weiner, instead of making a conventional TV show, has made, I don't know, I think like 8 movies, and is releasing them as a TV show. I think that's fascinating.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, we are in the golden age of television right now. And by the way, the one thing that we do know is that films in general are slowly slipping. When I say film, I mean independent film. I think it's a really difficult time right now. It's very hard to get a movie made. And thank God that, something like Amazon are, you know, letting Matt go and basically tell sort of 8 individual films. I know there's the connective tissue like we talk about, but when I read my episode, I was like, oh, this is a great movie. Like, you know, it read like a film. It had a beginning, middle, and end. It stood on its own 2 feet. It felt independent. And it, the brilliance of Matt will be, you know, how he's sort of interweaving each one. And there will be the connections, which I can't wait to see for myself. But it's sort of a lovely, lovely thing that one's able, because it's one wouldn't be able to go and do this in cinema right now, you know?
Right, absolutely. We talk all the time about the death of the mid-level and the death of the independent film, and it's only big blockbuster franchises now, and there's not room for this kind of storytelling, so it's moving to TV. And
yes, exactly.
I think that's fascinating. My last question for you is, I've heard some fun stories about the extreme amount of detail that Matt puts into his scripts, you know, more than maybe other screenwriters. Are there any details, like really, really specific details that you remember for your character where you're like, okay, well, that's just, it's right there. I don't even have to think about it. Matt has thought about it and put it into the script already.
I'd say like everything was in there. I mean, like he really, like I said, when I say micro to the micro detail, like I'm saying Matt's on another level. I've never worked with someone with more attention to detail. But that's the beauty of it. Like I said, you're giving yourself over to someone like that because you know they know best. So he can, at any question you have, he'd have the answer, which I think is so comforting. And you know, I think there are a couple of times like where he added a line, but pretty much everything was there already. I mean, I'm trying to think of something that like he hadn't thought of or anything like that, but we discussed everything. I mean, he's down to the fine detail in like the costume, the hair, the makeup, every single thing. And it was all his whole team as well from Mad Men. So everyone was like old friends, which is great.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for your time and for this lovely episode. And good luck if you have to do a million more interviews after this. Good luck with those.
No, you know what, Johnny? You are my last.
Oh, the last and the best. Excellent. Well,
the last and the best. Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent. I'm with you. This is so nice. But lovely speaking to you. Thank you for the questions.
You as well. Thanks so much. Bye.
Hi, Johnny. Bye, love. Bye.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, we want to talk about the ending of this episode, you know, which is really like, I don't know, it happened and I was like, oh my God, that's where we're leaving it. And that moment where, the Olivia character winds up dead, really crystallized for me what the episode was about. Well, how did it land with you?
Well, yeah, I'm curious to hear what you have to say, because I was thinking about it afterward and, you know, I'm saying, did she have to die? Is it a kind of shitty view of you know, women that she gets killed at the end. You know, I don't know, but I also think that, I don't know, this feels like a showrunner, a writer who has been accused of things, who wrote a seminal piece of television that was very much about misogyny, almost apologizing in a way, if that makes any sense. Like, look, I understand that in all of this, look what I did, you know, in the name of art.
Yeah.
Look what I did,
yeah.
You know, and so I don't think that he is making Olivia any weaker by the fact that she dies. It's more the forces kind of bearing down on her were too much to handle.
Yeah, no, I don't think it positions Olivia as weak at all. That wasn't my takeaway. It's not like, oh, you know, he had to make the woman so vulnerable. It's just sort of like, yeah, the system, the maliciousness of the system, and how little regard it has for the women, especially, that it chews up and spits out. Once again, I guess I would go back to the Bob Isaacson character, played by Paul Reiser, who mentions throughout all the ways in which he's literally profiting off of having her as a client. He's like, oh, I took a private plane back from New York, and that's because of you. She's like, that's a terrible thing to tell me. Like, why would you say that to me? Like, he's just saying all that all the time. She is a business investment for him. She's not a human. And that's the way in which a lot of people in general in the industry, but especially women, are seen. And so I don't see that ending as being, aggressive towards her or weakening her. I see it as being an aggressive condemnation of the system that put her there. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really effective. And I think I really appreciate how, defiantly or strange the episode is. You know, I really grooved on it in a way that I didn't with the past two. I liked the past two, but this made me lean closer and be like, okay, what is this about? You know?
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
Yeah, I think for me, like, if we're sort of rating the series so far or what have you, like, the back half of the second episode or the Carrie Bechet half of the second episode really landed well with me, and this episode really landed well with me. And there's another episode, like I said, I've seen like six of them. There's another episode that just like really, really hit with me. And interestingly enough, it's all these like female characters, these female centric stories. And so once again, I don't know if that's like Matthew Weiner making, some kind of amends, or if it's just me, like that those are the kind of stories that I naturally gravitate towards or whatever it is. But I think that that's what's been most effective in terms of what I've seen from the Romanoffs, which once again, the main theme being like, power, aggression, entitlement, all this sort of stuff. And it's like, what do women do in that system? It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think that the reason for, I haven't seen the other episode you were talking about, but that the women centered storylines so far have been more interesting is, I mean, we had how many seasons of Mad Men? We've seen Matthew Weiner talk about shitty men, you know, and he's still talking about them, but like, he's at least trying to frame it in a different way. We should not discredit Mary Sweeney, who also wrote the episode. But you know, if we're going to be watching something by him, like I'm glad that thus far he has not tried to frame it in such a way of like, well, I can't help but tell a misogynistic story because those are the times, you know, or whatever. I'm glad that he's seems to be actually grappling with stuff and how sort of geared towards atonement that is. I don't know, but it feels it's at least glancing in that direction.
Absolutely. Well, that it can only be our hope for the rest of the series. I am glad for all of you who have chosen to listen to this series. Thank you for listening to us grapple with our inner doubts and demons, for a lot of this episode. And, once again, you can reach us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. If you have your own thoughts about, like, you know, what requires cancellation, what doesn't in a person, what, you know, what art, you know, is worthwhile, what isn't, you know, all of that. I'm interested for this to be an ongoing conversation because I think this is one of those really interesting gray areas. Some people, it's like a no-brainer. I'm like, oh, I'm done. That's easy. Okay. And then this, I think, is more complicated. And I think that that is the part that's more interesting to grapple with. As we continue to grapple, Richard, where can people find you?
In a pit on fire with the rest of my family. that was dark. No, they can find me at Twitter on Ryla as Rylaws and on VF.com. Where, Joanna, can people find you?
Oh, meticulously rearranging my Rasputin shrine. But when I'm not doing that, find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This or at VanityFair.com. We will see you next week with episode 4 of The Romanoff.
The Romanovs.
I'm Olga Romanov.
Michael Romanov.
He said he was a Romanov?
You know, she's a Romanov.
Checking in for a Romanov.
I'm a Romanov. So tired of this Romanov shit?
Nicholas Romanov.
I could be a Romanov.
He's a Romanov too.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.